This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
I do think that the World Court has been a successful institution, even though it has not been able to prevent war, because that was a charge which it was never capable of bearing.
A conversation with the American judge on the World Court on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. You may not have been aware of it, but we're in the midst of the United Nations decade of international law. So what better place to check on what's happening in international law than at the World Court, which is, after all, the judicial arm of the United Nations. Located at The Hague in the Netherlands and known officially as the International Court of Justice, the World Court only hears cases that involve entire countries. It does not try cases between or against individuals. There are 15 judges on the court. The only American on the court has been there since 1981. He is the Honorable Stephen Schwebel, and he's our guest today. We begin our conversation with Judge Schwebel explaining how the World Court grew out of the 19th century peace movement and a very famous case right after the U.S. Civil War involving the United States and Great Britain.
Modern international arbitration received a great thrust forward in 1871 when, in the aftermath of the Civil War, the United States and Great Britain agreed to arbitrate a very bitter dispute they had over the so-called Alabama claims. You may remember that the Confederate cruiser, the Alabama, was the most successful of the many Confederate cruisers in sinking a great number of Union ships. The Alabama had been built in a British shipyard and was outfitted with armaments in a British shipyard and permitted to sail and set out on its career. And the United States claimed, after the conclusion of the Civil War, that Great Britain had acted in violation of its neutral duties under international law by permitting the building and outfitting of a Confederate cruiser. And asserted very large claims because the losses inflicted by the Alabama were tremendous. And this matter was put to an arbitration tribunal of five states, or arbitrators named by five states, which arrived at an award in favor of the United States, which Great Britain duly paid. And it was an immense amount of money for that day. The dispute was a very serious one. I mean, it was one that at times was even thought to threaten war between the United States and Great Britain. And therefore, the settlement in this way was a big event and led many persons who were interested in trying to avoid recourse to war to think of arbitration as the means of doing it. And that in turn led to the production of a large number of treaties among states, led by Great Britain and the United States, providing that in the case of disputes between them, they would go to arbitration. And that in turn was one of the impulses which lay behind the two Hague peace conferences, which took place in The Hague in 1899 and 1907, and which were the first world diplomatic conferences in the whole history of mankind. And at those conferences, a wide variety of ideas for promoting peace and for moderating the horrors of war were canvassed. And in fact, a substantial number of important conventions on the law of war, limiting the use of certain weapons, providing for the treatment of the wounded, etc., were entered into. Those Hague conventions were the basis of modern humanitarian law, which have been since replaced by the Geneva conventions.
The United States then proposed that this process of arbitration be replaced by a permanent institution or a world court.
And that proposal had very considerable support, but it founded particularly on the problem of who would compose the court. There were some 45 states at the Second Hague Peace Conference, which was virtually all the states of the world then independent. And there was no mechanism for electing judges. There was no standing diplomatic conference or assembly of states. These states had come together for the conference. They were going to adjourn. That was that. And since they couldn't agree on how to designate some among them, all said that each must have a judge on the court or there would be no court. And clearly it was not workable to have a court of 45 judges, so there was no court. And it wasn't until the League of Nations came into being in 1920 with organs of the international community for the first time again in the history of the world, was it possible to elect a world court. And the covenant of the League provided that the League should take steps to establish a permanent court of international justice, and that in fact was very promptly done.
Well, obviously these international treaties and laws haven't prevented wars. We've had two major world wars in this century. But in your opinion, have they at least ameliorated the effects of the war or perhaps prevented some other wars?
I would not say that international arbitration or adjudication has generally or substantially been successful in preventing war. I think that perception of the peace movement of the 19th century, which was so energized by the Alabama claims experience, was a mistaken perception. The problems of war go beyond, I think, the procedural device of recourse to third-party adjudication, however significant and useful that can be in some circumstance. Nevertheless, I think that international arbitration has made very positive contributions to the settlement of a large number of international disputes and runs into many thousands by now. That's not generally appreciated, but the number of arbitrations is immense. These last 10 years, there's been sitting in The Hague the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal, an arbitral tribunal which has dealt with many hundreds of claims between the United States and Iran and American nationals and Iranian companies and so on. But I do think that the World Court has been a successful institution, even though it has not been able to prevent war because that was a charge which it was never capable of bearing. But what it has done very successfully is resolved on the basis of legal principle a substantial number of disputes between states, many of which were quite important, some of which less important, and in the process has contributed very much to the development of international law. Just as, in a sense, as the common law courts and the common law contributed to the growth of the common law in a primitive legal system, so the world court in the primitive legal system, which is international law today, makes its contribution.
Clearly, I think the World Court and the United Nations indicate progress to you, or you wouldn't have devoted so much of your life to them. But how do you respond to the people who fear individual countries such as the U.S. are giving up too much of their sovereignty or ability to act unilaterally when submitting to such institutions?
Well, I don't react very positively to that apprehension. I think that a state, when it concludes a treaty and takes on an international obligation or submits itself to international adjudication or participates in the processes of the World Health Organization or the International Labor Organization or the World Bank, etc., etc., is exercising its sovereignty. It's not relinquishing its sovereignty. It's doing something constructive rather than something destructive with its capacity of governance and its capacity to project its resources and the like.
Of course, the World Court can't force any country to abide by its decisions. Is that frustrating for you?
Well, up to a point. I think it certainly is dispiriting to see the court, as it did last April, issue an order calling upon states involved in the conflict on the territory of the former Yugoslavia to do all within their power to prevent the perpetration of atrocities and then see that nevertheless those atrocities go on. I should think it's at least as frustrating for the delegates in the Security Council and the states represented there to have seen that its resolutions have been no more effective, but that's no comfort to the court.
I think equally frustrating would be when some countries don't even bother to show up at court when a complaint has been lodged against them.
Yes, that is frustrating. It's exceptional, but it's happened about a half a dozen times in the post-war years. And in those cases, if the court finds that it has jurisdiction, under its statute is entitled to go ahead and render judgment even in the absence of a defendant.
What's the record of the court in getting countries who come before it to actually adhere to its ruling?
Well, the court doesn't get them to do it. I mean, they are bound to do it by the terms of the statute, and they almost invariably do it of their own volition and because of their interest in the maintenance of the system. I mean, there are, I think, four cases in the history of the court in which the court has rendered a judgment which has not been complied with by the defendant. So in the great majority of cases, the parties have carried out the judgment of the court, and it's not been the court that impels them to do so. The court has no sheriff, no police force. It cannot impose fines for contempt of court, and so forth. It doesn't have at its disposal the coercive apparatus which courts in a national system may.
There was a very famous case during the 1980s when the Nicaraguan Sandinista government brought a case before the court accusing the U.S. of mining its harbors. Is that one of those cases that you're referring
yes.
to? What were the details of that case? The U.S. decided not to go along with the court's decision in that. Is that essentially
well,
correct?
That's essentially correct, but there's a great deal more that can be said about that case. It's a complex and important one. The then Sandinista government of Nicaragua complained that the United States was, through its intelligence agencies and through support of Nicaraguan rebels known as the Contras, mining Nicaraguan waters, blowing up Nicaraguan governmental oil stocks, and taking measures designed to overthrow its government. The United States did not deny that it had mined the waters, blown up the oil stocks, and was supporting the Contras, though it did not accept the view that it was trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Rather, its defense was, essentially admitting the acts as accused, that it was exerting these pressures on the government of Nicaragua in order to deter the government of Nicaragua from pursuit of that government's attempts to overthrow the governments of its neighbors, El Salvador, Guatemala, Costa Rica, most of all El Salvador, which was then locked in a very bitter civil war. Nicaragua denied this. They said they sympathized with the revolutions in those countries, but were not in any way materially supporting those revolutions. But in any event, the court, by a severely divided majority, held that there was jurisdiction. The United States at that stage claimed that that decision was so manifestly an error, and that the court, in the course of reaching it, had committed certain violations of due process so serious that it would not participate in the stage of the merits, and it did not. And the court then proceeded to judge the merits and made a judgment which essentially accepted the Nicaraguan claims as to the behavior of the United States and also accepted the Nicaraguan claims as to what it was not doing. The problem with that decision, in my view at the time, which has, I think, been confirmed beyond any reasonable doubt by revelation since, is that the Sandinista government misled the court and didn't tell the truth. And in fact, it was engaged in a very emphatic campaign of trying to overthrow neighboring governments by supporting insurrectionist movements. And as Exhibit A in this conviction of mine, I would point to the explosion which took place in Managua last May of a huge arms dump. And it turned out that this was a dump of the Salvadoran insurrectionists, which was being kept in the capital of Nicaragua under the auspices of the Sandinista army. The Sandinistas still being in charge of the Nicaraguan army. And so I think it's really clear to any objective observer now that the court was badly misled on essential facts of the case. In my view, that was profoundly unfortunate, but there were other very unfortunate elements in the case, too.
In cases such as the one that the Nicaraguan government brought against the U.S., is it a problem for you in separating your interests as a U.S. citizen from your interests as a justice of the World Court?
Not an insurmountable problem. I think that any judge necessarily views a case through his particular perspective and experience and may be influenced by it. And I think it would be naive to suggest that anyone can be totally objective and wholly uninfluenced by his nationality, background, education, and the like. That simply is I think, impossible. But nevertheless, we have judges and the whole process of adjudication because of the belief that an individual, given a judicial responsibility and with appropriate training for it, sufficiently separate his personal predilections, to the extent they exist in the matter, from a reasonably objective assessment of the case. And I think that by and large, at any rate, judges of the World Court manage to do that successfully, and I think in my own case I've managed to do it.
What's interesting to me is in looking at the dozen or so cases that are now before the World Court, the U.S. is the most often named defendant. What does that say to you? Does it have anything to do with the fact that the U.S. is really the only superpower left?
No, I don't think you can draw too much of a conclusion from that. For example, until a few weeks ago, Australia, which is certainly far from a superpower, was a defendant in two cases. And 2 years ago, El Salvador, a tiny state, was involved in two cases. I think it's just the roll of the dice at a particular time.
A couple of decades ago, the court had no cases on its docket, and does the fact that it now has these dozen cases indicate a renaissance of the World Court? Is there any connection to, there appears to be a renewed interest in international relations or international institutions in this post-Cold War era?
Well, I think it's hard to be certain as to why recourse to the court has grown so much in the last decade, I think a reasonable speculation is that with the relaxation in international tensions as the Cold War has wound down and then expired, there's more of a disposition of states to have recourse to third-party means of settlement than before. And that would be the court, but not only the court, it would also be the United Nations and regional organizations. If you look at the history of the court in the interwar years, the court flourished in the 1920s during a period of détente and did very little in the 1930s in a period of high international tension. On the whole, when states are dealing with massive aggression and when there are high international tensions, the prospects of putting those disputes to an international court are pretty slim. I don't think you see that the World Court produces peace so much as peace produces the World Court. If you have an era of relatively peaceful and friendly relations, nevertheless, there'll still be plenty of international disputes. And in such an era, there is more of a disposition to settle those disputes by recourse to a court than in an era of high international tensions.
You're listening to Common Ground, a program on world affairs sponsored by the Stanley Foundation. My guest is Judge Stephen Schwebel, one of the 15 justices on the World Court and the only American justice on the court. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. As a layperson, one of the most familiar cases for me, and this really doesn't have to do with the World Court, but was the Nuremberg trials against the Nazi perpetrators. Why were trials like that conducted by the U.S., the victors, instead of an institution like the World Court?
Well, the technical reason, at any rate, was that there was no institution then in existence which would have had jurisdiction in such a case. The World Court, set up in 1922, was still then in existence, but by the terms of its statute, it could only adjudicate cases between states. It could not try individuals. And the essence of the Nuremberg trials was individual responsibility for state crimes in which the individuals had taken a leading role. You see that there had been a tradition of persons cloaking themselves in state responsibility and saying that whatever was done by a state didn't implicate them as individuals. They were simply carrying out orders. And the revolution brought about by the Nuremberg trials was to throw over that a plea of superior orders as being an all-embracing and exculpatory plea, and to hold individuals responsible for absolutely incredible violations of human rights and the right to life and the most elemental morality. So I think myself that the Nuremberg trials were an enormous step forward in international law and in the most fundamental precepts of international, national, and personal morality. A very good thing indeed. Now today, the Security Council has set up a new international tribunal to prosecute persons accused of grave breaches of humanitarian law in former Yugoslavia. And that is in line with this Nuremberg precedent. Except one can say that would not be a trial conducted by the victors of the defeated. The question is whether there'll be trials at all, whether it'll be possible to get a hold of persons accused of committing the acts. The virtue of a trial of the accused by the victors is that the victors had possession of the accused. That was the case in Nuremberg, insofar as they hadn't perished in the fighting, as Hitler is presumed to have done, or poisoned themselves, as Goering succeeded in doing, and so on. But at least they had major defendants there. It remains to be seen whether this will be true in Yugoslavia.
That lesson from the Nuremberg trials seems to be a lesson that has to be relearned over and over, the one of personal responsibility.
Yes, I mean, however necessary and right and moral and compelling the Nuremberg trials were, it's certainly true that they've not succeeded in effectively deterring further massive atrocities, as we've seen in Yugoslavia, Cambodia, other places.
I just have one final question, and it's more of an observation, and that was when I was a news reporter covering courts, most cases, the domestic cases, involved one individual against another or the state against an individual. And these cases that you deal with when an entire nation brings a complaint against another nation are so large, and The Hague, where the court is located, is so far from the site of this, whatever the conflict is, that it would almost seem abstract. And is it difficult for you to keep in mind that your decisions could affect large numbers of individuals? And is that important to you, to always keep that humanity in mind?
No, I don't think it's difficult to keep that in mind, and certainly it is important to do so. I mean, it's not at all difficult to do so in a case in which the horrors perpetrated against innocents are as vivid as they are in Bosnia today. I mean, on the contrary, it is painful to review the evidence. It's quite a sickening record to immerse oneself in. Other cases do tend, many of them, to be much more abstract, particularly questions of maritime boundaries, for example. But nevertheless, very real human interests may be involved. For example, the court 10 years ago adjudicated a very long-standing and profound dispute between the United States and Canada over fishing rights in the Gulf of Maine, or the territorial boundary in the Gulf of Maine, which implicated fishing rights. And that dispute was of very high interest to the fishermen involved. I mean, their livelihoods depended in some measure on where the line was drawn. So it's certainly important to those people, and I think the court does bear that in mind.
Justice Stephen Schwebel has been our guest on Common Ground. He's one of the 15 World Court judges located at The Hague in the Netherlands. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to purchase a cassette of this program with Justice Schwebel, please call area code 319-264-1500. That's 319-264-1500. Or you can write in care of the Stanley Foundation, 216 Sycamore Street, Suite 500, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, that's 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground is produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.